Welcome to Making Sense of MarTech, an irregular set of conversations with some of the most interesting people in marketing, tech, and advertising. I'm Juan Mendoza. I write the MarTech Weekly Newsletter. It's a weekly email that uncovers the important shifts in marketing technology. You can read, listen, and subscribe at themartechweekly.com. Before we go into our episode today, I would love to share with you something new from the MarTech Weekly. It's called TMW 100. We've launched a new MarTech Innovation Awards program ranking MarTech companies from first place to 100th place globally. We're announcing the winners in the first week of November in Anaheim, California, live with Mopsapalooza from MarketingOps.com. Our judges include folks like Scott Brinker, Daryl Afonso, and Jessica Cow. If you're building innovative marketing technology, I invite you to prove it at themartechweekly.com/TMW100. That's themartechweekly.com/TMW100. All right, back to our show. Okay, today I'm joined by a very special guest, Shoshana Wodinski. She's a technology researcher and a former investigative reporter doing some of the best investigative journalism in the tech industry I think I've ever seen. And I'm going to be on record for saying that. But Shoshana, she's actually just started a new role as an investigative director for a consulting firm called Web X-Ray. Shoshana has had her work shared far and wide and cited by organizations such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. She's a prolific writer. Some of her articles are entitled How Google Ruined the Internet, According to Texas. Here's How California's Prop 24 Could Be Better or Break Our Privacy for Good. Opportunism, Thy Name is Zuckerberg, just to name a few. So in this episode, we talk about the ad tech dumpster fire, the problem of privacy in the world of tech giants, and why Shoshana has dedicated a career to investigating tech companies from a privacy and an ad tech lens, how to balance enabling free online content and services while preventing the surveillance of consumers, among many other topics. And now I give you Shoshana. How are you doing?
Wow, that is quite the intro. Thanks for inviting me on to talk about this very kind of prescient topic, I guess you could say. It's always an interesting time to talk about ad tech and MarTech, but now, you know, sometimes are more interesting than others.
Yes, it always feels like we're on the precipice. There's always change, there's always something new, there's always some existential risk. You know, I guess that's what makes the industry exciting.
Exciting is definitely one word. Frustrating is another one. I'm pretty sure, like, every time I talk to folks, they're always just like, today is the day that I finally give up my agency job for good, or today's the day that I leave publishing. And then 2 weeks later, they're like, I'm back in the slop. Can't do it. No, but it's great. It's people definitely have very strong opinions about very complicated, wiggly pieces of tech. That always makes for a very good story, is what I found.
Yeah, I mean, it's always vacillating between, wow, this is exciting, what an amazing new frontier, and then also, holy crap, like, what am I doing with my life and my career? You know, like, I feel like there is, particularly in ad land, there is this existential problem of, like, you know, this is a classic thing where people say, we're getting the brightest minds in the world to get people to click on things, you know, and there's always that existential problem, I think, of like, is this actually good for the world, what we're doing in ad tech? And I am very interested to hear your thoughts on some of the angles as to why people might be feeling that way. But I guess I want to get your story first, Shoshana. I mean, how did you get into the rabbit hole, which is reporting on ad tech and all the different things around the tech industry related to data collection and privacy and obviously advertising as well?
Well, my background, it's funny enough, my background's actually in neuroscience. I spent about 5.5 years getting a degree basically in rat mutilation. I was in charge of the rat, we called them sacrifices, for a research lab during that time. And I was specifically studying things like childhood development, addiction, mental disease, that sort of thing. And then, you know, after about 3/4 of the way through of being in a windowless building and writing research papers and like doing work that I'm pretty sure nobody was ever going to read, I was like, you know what? I wonder if there's anything more than this. So I lucked out. I applied to a bunch of science journalism jobs because I figured, what's the opposite of being in a windowless building? It's talking to the world on a public platform. That's what journalism does. So I applied. I ended up going to NYU, their science reporting program, for back in like 2018, I think. And pretty quickly when I was there, I noticed that a lot of my colleagues in the industry that I was about to step my foot into, were being laid off. And I couldn't understand why. However, I noticed that tech reporters seemed to be laid off less frequently than my friends that like wrote about cells and science and stuff. Later on, I would realize this is mostly because of affiliate links. But at the time, I was like, oh, maybe there's some sort of magic sauce to tech reporting that that I'm missing here. So I started kind of like looking into that. And then I was actually in journalism school when SUSTA-FOSTA happened here in the US. And I saw a lot of folks online kind of critiquing this very broad piece of tech policy. And I saw kind of the fallout of that from various kind of public figures online who were like, people are suddenly homeless or going missing because the US doesn't really... I'm going to choose my words very wisely here. The US is definitely knows how to craft tech policy in a way that impacts very specific groups of people, is all I'll say. Okay. So after, yeah, exactly. You can get what I mean. But after that, I scored some internships working for places like The Verge and NBC News, mostly writing about things like disinformation and like influence on different platforms. And then I graduate. Naturally, there's no jobs writing about anything for somebody fresh out of J school. And this guy, Josh Sternberg, over at Adweek, reaches out to me and he's like, hey, it's 2019. Cambridge Analytica just happened. Do you want to like basically write how the Death Star operates for people that work on the Death Star? And I was like, oh, interesting. Tell me more. Then I met some of the other reporters there and they kind of like walked me through the beats of how, of like what I would be writing about. And I was like, oh, this is unspeakably dull and unspeakably complicated. When does the Death Star stuff like come in? And after about 2 weeks, like it hit me like a truck. And I was like, oh, all of the pitches are kind of bullshit. All of the tech is really invasive. And everything's just under this very glossy facade for the sake of venture capital. So after some time, so naturally, when you write for a trade audience, things can be a little bit toned down. So I started just tweeting about a lot of the stuff I was finding. And this was like right before the 2020 election. So somebody at Gizmodo reached out to me, the site gizmodo.com, the tech news website, reached out to me and was like, you know, I feel like this is going to be kind of important in the coming, the stuff that you're talking about might be important for like persuading like politics. Like, maybe you should write about that here. And I said, I am Canadian, but I can put on a brave face for you guys. So after being there for about 2.5 years, mostly writing about all of the stories that you cited before were during my time at Gizmodo, where I was literally writing about a topic, well, various topics that had never been covered in the public, kind of outside of the trades before. So I was talking to like lay people, like people, like people's like moms and like aunts on their couch about like what a DSP was, how header bidding worked, what commercial surveillance is kind of what I called it, like what that looks like in practice. And it ended up being like, not to toot my own horn, it ended up being kind of revolutionary because a lot of other reporters at other outlets started kind of following my lead and basically trying to copy this beat for themselves. Because until then, a lot of privacy reporting was mostly focused on government surveillance and police and like facial recognition, which is totally important, but not at all what I was writing about. So after about like my tenure there, again, not to toot my own horn, but I want to believe it kind of expanded what people could think privacy reporting was. I think it was pretty successful. I got to I would write groundbreaking pieces like, hey, you know the Facebook audience network exists? And then radio stations would have me on and be like, wow, this piece of investigative work is great. And I would be like,
in the account, log in, you can do it yourself. Yeah. And that's a fascinating thing. I mean, I think that's like your career has kind of come right at that crux of Cambridge Analytica, which was that, like, it was just a total temperature change across how journalism was covering tech up until that point. I mean, I started my career before Cambridge Analytica and then afterwards. And in terms of just the media environment, it's completely different. It's completely different. I mean, I remember how hyped and how exciting and how forward-looking tech was, even in just media before Cambridge Analytica. Very little criticism, you know, very little criticism. And
sorry, yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, you know, I was going to say, so it's funny, like I've talked to a few folks about this because I came into this blind. Like I wasn't really, I have no exposure to being a tech reporter before, like in the pre-Cambridge Analytica era. But from my understanding, there was the era of hype, then Cambridge Analytica happened. And now, well, then we were in the era of Crita hype, is kind of what it's called, where people take, like, for example, Cambridge Analytica was boasting all of their ability to, like, persuade voters and all the data they were collecting, yada, yada, yada. And journalists just took that and ran with it without really acknowledging that ad tech is 99% garbage. And years later, you see like a decent settlement from Facebook. Everyone that was at Cambridge Analytica, I'm pretty sure, still works in ad tech and data analytics. The company dissolved, but of course it would. And people in ad tech to this day are just like, this is such a nothing burger of a story. What was the big deal? And my kind of running theory is it was the first time that the world of kind of like weird, wonky, like technology, like the trade stuff that I was doing, collided with the privacy, like the people covering cops, privacy, politics, that sort of thing. It was the first very public case of those two worlds colliding, and nobody knew what to do. People were like, we don't know how to do anything but take people at face value.
Yes.
Because when a cop makes a statement to the press, honestly, like, you understand that they might be lying, but you do need to kind of put that in print. Whereas if you're taking like a tech person, like up until that point, we had just been taking tech people at their word because we were all like, oh, tech is great. And suddenly we were dealing with tech people that were kind of acting like cops. So it was kind of like, for a lack of better word. So instead of just assuming, oh, they're lying, we just kind of assumed, or not lying, I'm going to say stretching the truth.
Yeah.
Instead of assuming that, we were just like, oh, tech is mystical, wiggly, magic stuff. Of course these people know what they're talking about. And then only now are we starting to kind of understand that that's not always the case.
And I think that, like, even now, like, I think we've been, so we had the press cycle, I think Cambridge Analytica, when those stories broke, that was back in 2017, 2018. And now fast forward 4 or 5 years, regulation is starting to catch up. And, you know, we've had obviously GDPR that broke around similar times. So, you know, around that sort of 2016 to 2018 period, you had regulation from Europe. You had Cambridge Analytica break, and then you had this, I wouldn't call it pessimism. I think I would probably call it, as you say, like it's more a critical eye from a journalistic perspective on how big tech operates. But I would say that now we're kind of right into this, I would say almost like a death spiral in tech, where you've just got all of this regulation that's spiraling. Even OpenAI, there is a class action lawsuit, more than $3 billion that is being alleged for privacy violations from just ChatGPT, a product that launched 6-7 months ago. But you've got Meta, you've got Google, you've got the DOJ case against Google, you've got, you know, even Meta's new Threads app, Twitter competitor, which let's see how it goes, it just launched as we have in this conversation. You know, they can't operate that in the EU because of the GDPR privacy regulations. And so it does seem like the walls are closing in a bit on how big tech can operate, who they can acquire, which markets they can go into, what products, what data they can collect. And now we're starting to see this shift where it's actually becoming quite constraining for anyone in tech to actually do anything. And so it is a fascinating shift. I'm not sure if it will go the other way where things will open up again when we see the, I guess, the consequences. But I think I'm kind of in your camp in that, you know, we've been living in 20 years of quote-unquote surveillance capitalism, where it's not the government surveilling its citizens, it's tech corporations surveilling its citizens, and they've had pretty much open rein to collect whatever they wanted. And that is not good for society. That is not good for people's privacy. It's a human right. And so I think we're in this interesting time where now we're starting to see the walls close in on tech. Is that what you're seeing? Just in terms of how other, not just journalism, but other organizations are addressing the privacy problem?
So yes and no. I mean, we were talking before we started recording kind of about like how change happens slow in a lot of these spaces. But like here's an example. So GDPR happened. Everybody slapped consent banners following like the IAB's guidelines onto their website. And they were like, one and done. This is great. And I think 2022, I investigated some of these consent banners. And I was like, wait, people aren't passing like consent signals back at all. Like the TCF is more or less functionally useless. And I reached out to publishers to ask them about that. And they were like, yeah, we had basically no control over what we were putting on our site. We were just told, monetize or die, because that's how content on the web works. So this was in, 2018 GDPR happens, 2022, so that's 4 years. And now, I'm not sure if the UK is currently like wrestling with that, but if I were in their shoes, I would consider it, because hang on, I'm gonna like try to figure out like a good way to word this. If you spend 4 months under the sort of guise that you are giving people privacy, and then suddenly you discover that all you're doing is basically enriching middlemen who have no they have no reason to give anybody the privacy that you're supposedly giving them with this law. Can you consider your law actually like effective? Like I don't know. Sorry, that was like very kind of like roundabout. But it's only because, like you said, so much has been happening. There's been so like every state at this point is kind of unrolling their own kind of, here in the US, this is unrolling their own kind of comprehensive privacy law, because we don't really have something like GDPR here in the US. So I've been tracking all of them, and I've been tracking all of the loopholes that are exploitable in each one, and there are quite a few. And at the end of the day, it's just like, okay, we want to give people sort of the auspice of what privacy looks like to them, but does that actually mean anything? And my kind of what I've, that's a very existential question that over the years I've kind of come around to saying, if you feel safe, that's great for you. But privacy as a sort of concept, it's very personal, and the law can't capture all of the nuances that your very personal experience encompasses. So eventually, at least this is what I usually tell people, and they over time, like they hate this, but they tend to agree with me. The more stuff goes on, it's like I always just say, sometimes you have to settle for good enough, and whether it's good enough, I don't know. I don't make that call.
And I think that's great. So I think that there's like there's this challenge, which is consumers don't care very much about their own privacy. That's now shifting. Like some recent research from Pew Research Center is actually saying that consumers are increasingly concerned about the data that's being collected and shared and used on them. You know, so I think that's changing consumer sentiment. But for the talking line across ad tech and a big tech platform, social and the search platforms, has been most people don't care. I mean, look, I get a free service, it's been I get to connect with my friends, I get job opportunities, I get to create and build an audience, I go to create content. You know, who cares if I can find information? Who cares if they collect a bit of data about me, right? Where I've been on the web, or, you know, my email address, or my, you know, my gender or my demographic info. Like, who cares, right? But I think that your point is so salient and really quite important. which is, it's not actually about what consumers think right now. It's actually about what makes sense for society and for society to function well. I mean, Apple's been the company that's been really trying to change this narrative themselves. And they're kind of, I would say Apple's kind of regulating the web as a private tech corporation. You know, they've been obviously shutting down so much in the tracking ecosystem space on their own devices and platforms. But they say that privacy is a human right. If you buy a brand new iPhone and you turn it on for the first time, it'll ask you about data collection and it will say at the bottom that we believe that privacy is a fundamental human right. I've never seen Google say that. I've never seen Meta say that on any of their products, neither or of any other sort of ad tech companies. And so I think that's where we're in this sort of kind of this weird in-between space where a lot of consumers just are ignorant or they don't know. And the ones that do, they don't really care. But then we have tech companies like Apple saying, no, like we need to protect consumer privacy. And we can talk a little bit more about their incentives, which I think is quite fascinating. But in terms of like consumers and how they think about it, are you seeing that shift as well in terms of people taking more notice of privacy? Or is it still that just blanket, most people just don't care?
No, absolutely. Folks, especially like folks in the younger generation, like I've talked to like high schools, colleges, I've talked to countless people. I've gone into like shouting matches with folks, both on ad tech and on the end user side about this sort of stuff. Because like, I'm very much like a neutral party. I'm like, yeah, data has a very kind of specific role in the online economy that like is necessary for people like journalists to have a job and not be laid off. But at the same time, people also deserve to have control over where their data goes. And once you acknowledge that those are two sides of the same coin, it's like, oh, this is all a lot more complicated than I initially anticipated. But in general, a lot of my conversations boil down to when people say they want privacy, what they actually really want is transparency. And I totally agree with that. They want to know who's profiting off of their data, how they're being profiled, how they can opt out in a way that actually matters and that their data won't actually just be tied back to their devices again. They want to know all of that. And right now the ad tech supply chain is so murky and there's 12,000 players, I think is like the last count. It's so murky, it's so big, and it's really hard not to feel kind of hopeless. So when people say privacy, they're actually like, no. I just want a modicum of control. So when Apple's whole thing right now is basically a giant ad campaign. They'll put a giant billboard out there that says privacy. That's an Apple. And I'm like, but what they're actually doing is they are putting control or the modicum of control, like the idea of control. If you're ignoring the SCAD network and all that stuff. They're putting the idea of control back into consumers' hands. And finally, they're just like, yes, thank you. Did something. Because the alternative is really having nothing. There was one time where when Roe v. Wade was repealed here in the US, I ended up writing about this, but I was flooded with people asking me just like, how do I make sure that my data isn't being given to like anti-abortion groups or something like that for like persecution? Again, data in the hands of cops. That's what most end users really care about. And I, being a good noble tech journalist, obliged, and I wrote a very long Twitter thread where I was basically like, yeah, you need a burner phone, but you also have to do this and this and this and this and this and this and this. And only then can you to maybe not have your data like tied back to the cops. And after that, like, I got a lot of complaints from people who were just like, this is so much work. Like, why even care at that point? Why even try? And I'm like, yes, I agree. And I think when tech companies are saying people don't care, they're actually saying people are too resigned to care because they really don't have much of a choice. So even if Apple isn't giving them much, at least they're giving them something, or they're giving them something that looks like a choice. And because folks are so desperate, it's like, that's a really smart move on Apple's part.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Apple's unique as a large corporate tech company that they own both the operating system and a lot of services and the device, right? Like Microsoft. Yes, they have OS, but it's not as ubiquitous, particularly on mobile. You know, but then you have, I guess, you know, Meta building their big bet on the metaverse was to try and hedge away against from the platform risk of working on Apple's ecosystem. But they are really defining privacy. Like if you look at all of their features, Apple tracking transparency, even the private Relay, which is the iCloud service that kind of, it kind of works like Tor in a way where it masks your IP identity on the web when using Safari. Recently, they came out to say that on Safari, private mode and in a few other apps, they'll strip out UTM parameters, which is the link tracking that most people, digital marketers will use for tracking people on the web and where they came from to their website. So you've got all of these shifts. And I think that, like, I think what that will do, and I think the challenge with what Apple's doing is that it makes it harder for, say, publishers to be able to monetize their content with ads on an open web. And I mean, even if you look at some of the research now, a lot of ad spending on programmatic is diminishing. It's going to walled gardens. It's going to the likes of Apple and Amazon, who have rich first-party data, and less is being spent on programmatic advertising, which is that open web, you know, display ads across multiples of different publishers and websites. So it's actually like, okay, well, what does this look like? Does this mean that the shift of privacy means that we're going to be living in a world of different internets, the internet according to Apple, where developers and publishers will have to build specific websites for the purposes of being on Apple's platform versus being on Microsoft's or Google's or Meta's? You know, in some parts of the world, people think that the internet is Meta because it's the first app that's loaded on their smartphone and they don't have a computer, you know? And so I think that we're in this interesting phase where the concept of the open web is just making less and less sense. But I'm not sure if you had a comment on that.
What's really funny is like, oh, like, what does the internet look like? And I'm like, no. What does the world look like? Because like, for example, there's that grocery chain here in the US called Kroger. Maybe you've heard of it. They just rolled out like a programmatic platform, like just for them. And somebody, I remember I was reading about that on Twitter, and somebody commented, like, why don't they just like buy out a company like MediaMath that just went under? Like, why are they doing like O&O? And somebody commented underneath that, like, oh, it's all about their own rich first party data. That's all that this means. And I thought, like, I saw that, I'm like, wait a second. And I thought back to like, Hilton Hotel now has their own ad tech platform. Walmart has had one for a while. Target has a company called Roundel, which is pretty hilarious. When you see like that, it's all that really means is that people are like, oh, dip, suddenly we can't just all access data in one unified way anymore. The only way to survive is to have some sort of value proposition that Apple doesn't. And for a lot of retailers, that means just like, it just means becoming another Apple. So it's not just hardware. It's also like brick and mortar stores, which I am fascinated by. When I learned like CVS has like an ad platform, I was like, that's it. That's the end.
Yeah, but it makes sense. Like in MarTech Weekly, we wrote a piece, The Rise of Retail Media, which is, you know, there's actually two forces coming together in that space, which is you've got privacy restrictions, you've got all of these like changes to from a third-party cookie deprecation and all of these shifts on like where do you find really high quality like purchasing data, transactional data? Well, e-commerce and retail, of course. So that's a one shift. The other shift underneath is that retailers we're in an inflation crisis right now, cost of living through the roof, and, you know, they're trying to slash prices, margins are extremely thin on retail. Traditionally, margins have always been really thin. And so, you know, they look at ad networks and go, well, you know, BCG says that you can get 80 to 90% margin as a revenue stream by running ads on your e-commerce platform or, you know, using retail media and distributed networks. Okay, you know, like, and so you've got the incentive there for retail. And, you know, even Walmart, you wouldn't think of them as a tech company, but they actually sell apps on the Salesforce App Exchange. You know, like they have built some pretty interesting world, like class leading ads, apps and services around retail media and monetizing their own first party data. And so I think that it's kind of interesting, right? Because we can't have any, like, where does this leave the consumer? I mean, for the, you know, the land grabs and all of the different sort of ways of thinking about protecting your own data and, you know, the walled gardens, where does this leave the consumer? I mean, I don't want to have to sign up with my email address for every single service for the pure fact that a publisher or a retailer will want you want to collect your email address for the purposes of running ads against you. You know, and I think that's the challenge, is that like, where does the consumer sit in this million maze of different strategies to try and outcompete each other?
I mean, if you're talking about like news content in particular, like when GDPR passed, like I think like over 1,000, don't quote me on that, but I think several hundred US news outlets, just immediately they were just like, it's not cost effective for us to stay in here. We're just going to pull out of the EU entirely. So if you're an expat living in the UK, I'm pretty sure you still can't read Newsweek. Meanwhile, folks that were in the US, who were read in the UK, had to be like, well, damn, what do we do now? And a lot of them put up offer walls or email walls or something like that as a way to enrich their own first party data sources. And as an end user, I can tell you, that shit's annoying. It's really annoying. I have come up with so many rants just to read a goddamn article that like one of my friends wrote. And if you're not doing that, then you're covering your page in programmatic ads. And that's not a great user experience either. When I was at Giz, people would give me flack all the time for critiquing programmatic advertising on a page that while being paid effectively by the stuff I was critiquing. And my response to that was saying, well, sometimes you can live in a society and also ask for things to be better. Like, that's not a crime. And then they would go like, whoa.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. They would never.
Well, that's the point, is that, you know, like, I am very skeptical of the claim that first-party data will be the new type of track or the next identifier for, say, scaled advertising on the web, because there's a few problems with it. It relies on companies to orchestrate their own data. So if you ever worked in enterprise business, you know that most data is siloed, it's in different spots, it's very contaminated, it's messy, there's, you know, and it's not complete. And you know, the downfall and the beauty of third-party cookies was that it was an open source system. You know, nobody owned it. You know, there wasn't custodianship. It was just like this cookie that sort of, like, the only custodian was a user with their browser and their device. But now you have the custodian shift to the brand and the publisher, and being able to manage the first-party data is actually very difficult, very expensive, very costly. It requires a lot of investment and talent and tech to do it. The second bit is that it's just not enough of it. I mean, compared to third-party cookies and like distributed open tracking, I mean, first-party data is just like orders of magnitude less than what you collect in terms of volume. And so it's great for like lower funnel targeting and like retargeting and abandoned cart and all of the sort of lower funnel type stuff. And sure, you've got Amazon, you've got Apple with like, you know, millions, billions of records of users, but it's still like, for most brands, they just don't have enough of it. Not even enough to look like a decent enough audience compared to, say, third-party cookies. And the last bit is that if you're going to continue to ask data from customers, and more sensitive data, by the way, like their shopping preferences, their transactions, their biometrics, their location, which is all tied to a first-party identifier, then consumers are just going to share it less. Consumers ain't going to do that unless they see a proper value exchange. Like, what are you going to use this for? Why are you asking for my location? Why are you asking for this? And so that's why I'm very bearish on first-party data as sort of the next platform for like ad tech and using data. But I am curious, because you obviously see this world way more than I do.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if you've heard about this thing called like, what is it? UID, like 5.0 or whatever the hell it's called.
Yes.
Like, the trade desk.
UID 2.0.
2.0, yeah, sorry. Yeah. I didn't know where UID saga.
Yeah. I mean, even UID 2.0, it's like, I don't know if you've been through it, but the consent mechanism from UID 2.0 to get yourself off their network of email data, first-party data shared across different publishers, you have to go to a trade desk website and put your email address in to be wiped, right? And it's like, which consumer on earth is going to do that, right? Like, cookies were great because a user could just delete them, or they could use Tor or some other masking service, and they had complete control over the browser. I guess, you know, they had some control. But with first-party data in ad tech, consumers have even less control. And even Mozilla have said this in the past. They did a teardown of UID 2.0 and said it's even more privacy invasive because consumers have far less transparency, far less control over what data can be shared and collected.
This was never about the end user. It was all about like making sure that the value is still for brands. And like, Dan, they are going to do their darndest to keep up the status quo, no matter how terrible it is. But I'm thinking like, okay, if you are a average American, red-blooded American citizen, and your church has an ad platform, and your grocery store has an, and your pharmacy, and your doctor's office, and your god dang bus stop is running DOOH ads, how do you know? How is anyone able to opt out of all of that in any sort of like comprehensive way without pulling a Unabomber and just moving to a cabin in the middle of the woods? I don't know it's possible, which is why when I laid out bit by bit in that Twitter thread how to effectively go off the grid if you're afraid of cops getting your like medical data, most people were like, this is impossible. I'm not going to do it. I'm like, yeah, I don't blame them. This is the system that we set up right now, which is why you just kind of have to either settle for good enough or live like Ted Kaczynski, which is, and both of those things are totally valid lifestyles. Just as long as you don't do the rest of the stuff that Ted Kaczynski did.
But that's the point, is that like, should consumers choose between participating in society versus being surveilled by corporations that they'll never know? Like that's kind of what you're saying, is that there's a choice that consumers need to make, is that, you know, to totally avoid being surveilled or tracked, they have to literally live in a cabin and remove themselves from society and the economy and job opportunities and be able to, you know, all the things that people would want to do. I think that, you know, the extreme example here is, China's social credit scoring system and their surveillance system with video and identity tracking in public spaces as well. I mean, that's kind of the extreme edge of what we're talking about, which I think that we'll have Steve riots in the streets, particularly in America, if we had that kind of level of surveillance, you know. But that's a government top-down surveillance. And I think the biggest problem is that where consumers are just way too willing to allow services to dictate what they can and can't do. And this is kind of more of a philosophical point more than anything else, is that I think that most people don't want agency. People don't want to eliminate tracking because they have to think. They have to make decisions.
Agency is hard, but people have the choice whether or not to have it. Like at the very least, just give them like a...
I agree. I think that agency giving the choice, and people still have the choice, right? People don't need to use laptops and iPhones and technology devices, right? They don't need to shop at Walmart. They don't need to, you know, people do have choice, right? It's a free, like, I'm an Australian, but in the US, it's a free country. It's just as in Australia, right? We're a democracy. People have rights and they can choose, right? People can still choose, but the majority have already chosen. That's the point. The majority of people have already chosen to be surveilled for free services on the web. And so
it's kind of been chosen for them. Like if your parents sign up to like go to like school in like elementary school, chances are that school is using some sort of like an ed tech tracking platform that colleges can then plug into for like promotional purposes. Like that's a pretty common thing that happens here in the US. If you're like a kid and your mom like happens to like buy you clothing from Walmart, you're suddenly like, you're going to be bombarded with like Walmart ads for completely unrelated products. And you're a child. You don't know. So what I always tell people is we're given a choice when we're cognizant adults, but by then it's pretty much like it's too late. And like, while there are things like laws like COPPA and HIPAA in the US, there have been so many attempts to circumvent them at this point and so many kind of successful circumventions that, again, it's a panacea. It's people saying like, this is what privacy looks like, and people saying, okay, because they don't know that there's any other option.
I look at other analogies where like industries were not regulated, you know, and then they eventually were, like the airline industry, the coal and gas and, you know, all of those types of industries, emissions, you know, even building regulations, maybe obviously health and healthcare regulations and technology. And you look at all of that and like, you know, the airline industry is so regulated, it's impossible to start a new airline. Even if you had, say, like $10 billion to start an airline, to get through the regulatory hoops, you know, we've just seen this with OceanGate, right? Like tragic story, but that's a story of a company being able to side skirt regulations, safety regulations, to build a craft that was definitely not suited to reach the depths of the Titanic, you know, and because that's a small industry, not a lot of players, not a lot of oversight. But in bigger industries like airlines, there's way more regulatory oversight and there's way more controls over things like safety and, you know, the operational maintenance of the airlines and all the rest of it. So I think about it, I'm like, well, the internet is a technology. How do you regulate it? Well, it's been 20 years of kind of nothing. And then GDPR came on the scene and then we've kind of been progressing from there. But the internet, it doesn't, like, airlines is so different from the internet. We're talking about the open flow of information and services across a global population, not flying planes in the air for 80 people at a time, 120 people at a time. And so I'm kind of thinking, is this the situation where the internet is regulated like most other industries, or it's just a totally ungovernable? Like, there's just no possible way that you could regulate something like the web like you would other industries.
I mean, obviously, time will tell. Still pretty early. I want to believe it's somewhere in the middle. And I'll tell you why. Right now in the U.S., maybe you've heard about this, the FTC sued a data broker called Coachella not that long ago over multiple stories that emerged that the company allowed people to freely get, like, device identifiers or personal information from people that were attending, say, like, places of worship, abortion clinics, that sort of thing. The judge in that case recently, they ended up refiling it, but the judge initially dismissed the suit on the grounds that the harm that comes from a privacy violation, say like a cop buying data from Coachella and then using that to prosecute somebody, that very real harm is kind of too downstream. It's not concrete, like somebody dying when they crash in an airplane. It's a possibility. This could happen. And the FTC refiled their suit. We'll see what kind of comes out there. But I think that that was like kind of the first very concrete example of like the law in the US basically being like, we don't rely on coulda, shoulda, wouldas. We're gonna let people die in a bunch of airplane crashes before we actually take some to do something. And like, you know what? That's fine. You can like let industry do what industry does and try to make money. But I don't know. it'd be nice if they'd be a little bit more proactive.
And it's not as visible. I mean, a plane falling out of the air and killing hundreds of people is obviously extremely violent and visceral, right? Like, you can see it. But on the web, so much of the harm goes unseen. I mean, in terms of privacy violations, in terms of, you know, the rising risks of depression, anxiety on social media, misinformation, so much of that is invisible to us. This is, I think, our human limitation is that we're so used to seeing the things happen in real life and then reacting to those things. A plane falling out of the air, smog hanging over New York City because of the emissions problems. You can breathe it. You can see it. It's tangible. It's visceral. However, the web, so much stuff happens on a screen and you're not even aware of it. And I think that's one of our biggest flaws is that if we had, you know, and I think Cambridge Analytica was one of those sort of situations where it was very real and very obvious, but still it's like, we're talking about opaque concepts here. We're not talking about a physical plane falling out of the sky. We're talking about millions of data. We don't know what kind of data it is being shared with parties that we don't know who they are. How does it get there? What kind of services do they use? It's all very shrouded in mystery still. And I think that's one of the challenges. And I think you mentioned this before, where transparency is probably the big problem, not necessarily just privacy, but transparency, like making the invisible stuff on the web visible.
You mentioned the Chinese social credit system earlier. Can you tell me how a person's credit score in the US is calculated?
I have no idea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, Equifax and Experian, like using these shadowy, opaque algorithms, and we've all just kind of accepted that as a normal part of being alive because we don't really have a choice. If you want to, you got to give up the data if you want to like rent an apartment, for example. And like, if a plane falls out of the sky, and you're in that plane, you can say, I bet there's real mechanical issues that led to this happening. And those are your last thoughts before you die. But if you are turned down for an apartment because somebody, say, checked your credit score or used some sort of an applicant screening algorithm, you're shit out of luck. You really can't go back to them and be like, no, this data point that this company collected from this other company is wrong. Which is why, like, for example, people like dispute credit scores all the time. This is a possibility, like an option that people have here. Because yeah, algorithms are wrong. They're wrong kind of a lot. A lot of kind of government agencies rely on them because what else are we going to do? That's just the way things have always been. It's the status quo.
Well, that's it. Well, we may have to end it there on this extremely depressing note, which is effectively we have no power and control over our data, sadly. But we can be more prepared and more informed about, I guess, data privacy and how the internet is shifting. Shoshana, could you tell us a bit about Tubes, your new Substack, and where we can interact with you on the web? You mentioned Twitter as well, but maybe there are other places.
So Tubes is taking a bit of a hiatus only because I wrote 3 issues. And then I was like, I'm starting to get burnt out again. And then I left to Germany, got a new job, came back. And now here we are. I'm hoping to bring it back sometime this summer. If you want to follow me on the web, all my handles across all of the many Twitter alternatives, all socials is S. Wodinsky, Wodinsky, first initial, last name. Or you can check out my link tree at, I think it's like linktr.ee/S. Wodinsky. Again, I don't know how that stuff works. I run a Discord. It's fun.
So you've got a Discord. You've got Tubes, which is a Substack. We can also anticipate some news coming out from Web X-Ray, as that'll be dropping over the next few weeks. So there's plenty going on, plenty to interact with from Shoshana. As I mentioned, one of the most brilliant investigators I've ever met in this space, and has obviously have caused a lot of ripple effects across the industry. So we do regularly interview people just like Shoshana, people that are on the forefront of their industries every single week. So you can dive into the topics that subscribers care about. If you'd like to read and subscribe, you can head to themartechweekly.com. Or if you'd like to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, you can do that as well. Shoshana, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, dude.